Okay, Shabbat Shalom. Welcome to United Israel's Sabbath Study. It's a great day, and I am pleased to be with you today. I have a story to tell from the Torah, but before I get started on that, I wanted to make a couple of announcements. Number one, if you have not yet done so, I encourage you to go to unitedisrael.org, and you'll look on the right-hand side of the website, scroll down a little bit, and you can sign up for the bulletin. And the reason that I wanted to announce this today, it's been on my mind, and the officers and I have discussed this for quite some time. What we are trying to do with the bulletin is to connect our rich history with the modern age. And what do I mean by that? Basically, what we have is United Israel for many, many years published what it was called, the Bulletin. And that bulletin from 1944 came out monthly, sometimes bi-monthly. This particular document was really more like a magazine, and there were things that were published in it. In fact, in the original constitutions, a copy of which I happen to have with me right now, it actually says this: United Israel World Union intends to publish a monthly bulletin, which is to serve as the main organ of the corporation and the chief medium of unification for all members of the units of United Israel World Union. It will contain important Bible data and messages of current interest. And what began to happen once our current group took the leadership over of United Israel with the passing of our founder, David Horowitz, we moved that medium of communication with our members to the website. We brought it into the digital age. And so for many, many years, we thought that in many ways we were fulfilling this part of the Constitution of United Israel through the website. And that is the case. But just recently, James suggested that in my new role, perhaps I could post a bulletin of sorts, a note once a week, send that out to our membership, kind of give them a heads up on things that are going on, things that we're doing, messages of importance related to biblical research and so forth. And so this Friday, yesterday, I sent out the first official resurgence, if you will, of the UI bulletin. I would advise you to, or encourage you to sign up for that if you've not yet done so. One of the things that you'll see is you'll get this in your email. We'll also post it on the social media. But among other things, you'll get the link to the Saturday class. That will be plain there. You simply open up the email and you click the link. But there'll also be other major featured articles and so forth, the series that Ralph Bunton works on, the Remembering David Horowitz, the Portraits of the Past. There'll be links to our Facebook group and so forth. And then another feature that I put in this week is trying to keep up with our president, James Tabor, can sometimes be a daunting task. Like, he wrote six major articles this week on his newly designed or redesigned Tabor blog. So what I thought I would do is put links to all of those articles and things of that nature so that you can keep up. And then whatever happens to be new on the UI site. You know, if I write articles, which I did this week, I'll post those up. And then we'll also put up any new parts to our series that are popular at this point. One other thing that I'd like to bring up is that there's a section in our original Constitution that says members are invited to contribute correspondence and data for the bulletin. So, for instance, if you have partaken in our group and you're a member of our corporation or just an online viewer every Saturday morning, you want to announce a wedding, the birth of a child or something like that, please feel free to email me. I'll put a link in there that you can directly email me and send that correspondence. And I will be glad to put some of that in the United Israel Bulletin. And I wanted to add one other thing in talking about the bulletin. I was honored this morning after that first edition went out yesterday. Our president, James Tabor, sent a note, copied all the members of our board and the officers, and he has appointed me as the executive editor of the UI Bulletin. So I am very pleased to accept that this morning. And part of the thing that really excites me about this is that I have a lot of respect for our founder, David Horowitz, who for many years, from 1944, was the editor of the United Israel Bulletin. And he had press credentials at the United Nations, and I happen to have one of these cards that goes back to the 40s. It's actually a press card. And I will be wearing this proudly when I go to the United Nations. This week, there was something that came out on Facebook. It's called Ambassadors Against BDS. There will be a meeting on March the 29th that will be held at the United Nations General Assembly Hall in New York City. And David and Patty Tyler, I will be going, and possibly Chad Morrow, who you met here at the building in the last few weeks. So I'm excited about that. We'll be participating in what is called on their website high-level discussions on topics including the use of digital media, diplomatic tactics, all aimed to combat the BDS movement on college campuses and around the world. So for those of you who might not know, BDS stands for Boycotts, Divestments, and Sanctions. And it's a loosely affiliated group, though it's somewhat organized, I might say. Their whole mission is to delegitimize the state of Israel and to bring discredit through propaganda and so forth, to put sort of threatening type pressure on anyone who wants to go to Israel, especially in terms of like superstars, the movie actors and football players and so forth. So this conference is going to be held on March 29th, and I will proudly represent with my associates United Israel back in the UN, and so I'll be sure and keep you abreast of that situation. The bottom line is that everything that we are doing is meant to advance the original vision of United Israel World Union, an organization that for more than seven decades has taught biblical principles, shared a vision of the prophets, and presented the ideals of the kingdom of God to the entire world. So when we do the bulletin, we're advancing that original vision. And when we act on behalf of our constituents, it's for the same reason. So the other announcement for UIWU, do not forget to register online on our website, unitedisrael.org, for the upcoming conference to be held the last weekend of April. And if there's any way that you can make it here to St. Francisville, I highly encourage that. We'll have great speakers. We'll have time for fellowship and a lot of fun around in the evenings where we get into some good discussions. There'll be music, there'll be food. So if you're at all able, if you are close, if you think you can make it, I encourage you to sign up for that. One final thing in the way of announcements, I will be out beginning next week. I leave Friday for the Land of Israel. James and I will be leading our tour together. We'll be gone for 2 weeks, but I'll be posting plenty of pictures and videos, and in every way, just like when Dave and I went, we want you to feel like you're there. So please stay tuned. You'll be able to follow it on the website, follow it on social media, and so forth. So for the next two Sabbaths, Jodel Onstott has agreed to teach in my absence. So please log in and support that. Without further delay, our class for today. Today, I will be talking to you about the vision of Abram. The vision of Abram. This is our 10th study session taken from the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis. We are following, as you know, the ancient triennial reading cycle, and we are in the patriarchal narrative. Specifically, this is the third of what I would call the Abrahamic cycle of readings. So we have Avram, the father of all the faithful, as he is later known in religious history. Isaiah in chapter 51 tells us, those of you who chase after righteousness, those of you who seek Jehovah, look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who bore you. And we are going to do just that. Last week, I presented the 14th chapter of Genesis, which, among other things, has the story of the war where Avram participates in a war in which he was instigated to fight in order to do the right. He had to go and recover his loved ones who had been attacked, and he did that, and upon his return, he meets with a mysterious figure by the name of Melchizedek. If you missed that class, you can go back and look at it on YouTube. You can find it on our website to catch up. Now, upon returning from that meeting, we pick up with today's narrative, beginning in chapter 15, which tells us that immediately after, in fact, the word just says achar, but according to Rashi, whenever you see the word achar in this particular form, it generally denotes immediately following thereafter, and he cites many examples. So we are in Genesis chapter 15, and I will begin reading from the Transparent English Bible. If you will go with me to that document, I've uploaded it on the website. Most of you should have already downloaded this, but I want to begin reading Genesis chapter 15 from the Transparent English Bible. And it says, let me open up my Bible. And after these things, the spoken thing of Jehovah was toward Avram in the vision, saying, do not fear, Avram, I am a shield to you. Your wage is made abundant exceedingly. And Avram said, Adonai Jehovah, what will you give to me? For I walk stripped, and a son acquired is my house, that is Eliezer of Damascus. And Avram said, look, to me you've not given seed, and look, a son of my house is possessing me. And look, the spoken thing of Jehovah was toward him, saying, this one will not possess you, but indeed one who comes out from your insides, he will possess you. And he made him go out toward the outside, and he said, gaze, please, skywards, and count the stars, if you're able to count them. And he said to him, thus will be your seed. And he put trust in Jehovah, and he thought it to him justness. And he said toward him, I am Jehovah, who made you go out from Ur of the Chaldeans, to give you this land to possess it. And he said, Adonai Jehovah, with what will I know that I will possess it? And he said toward him, take for me a heifer being three, and a female goat being three, and a ram being three, and a turtle dove and a nestling. And he took to him all these, and he split them in the middle, and gave a man of his part to meet his fellow. And the birds he did not split. And the birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Avram blew them away. And it was the sun to come in, and a deep sleep fell upon Avram, and look, a terror, a large darkness was falling upon him. And he said to Avram, knowing, you will surely know, that a sojourner will be your seed in a land not to them, and they will serve them, and they will bring them low 400 years. And also the nation that they will serve I am judging, and after they will go out with large gathered property. And you will come toward your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good gray-headed age. And the fourth life cycle they will return, for the crookedness of the Amorite is not whole until here. And it was the sun coming in, and it was dark, and look, a fire pot of smoke and a torch of fire. that passed over between these pieces, and on that day Jehovah cut with Avram a pact, saying, to your seed I give this land, from the river of Egypt unto the large river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, and the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. Now, this particular reading, that chapter is without break. From the beginning in verse 1 until the conclusion at verse 21, it is presented by the ancient scribes as a continuous narrative. The flow does not stop. There are no white spaces, as we've talked about. This is presented as a single flowing narrative. Now, beginning in our reading, there is a phrase that I think is quite incredible. It occurs 433 times in Scripture. For the first time, it occurs in this particular Torah reading. And that phrase is Devar Yehovah. It's translated in this particular translation by Dr. Tabor as a spoken thing of Yehovah, the spoken thing of Yehovah. Now, this particular phrase, as you will see as we work through the biblical narratives, occurs quite frequently, 433 times, as I've stated. And it's quite significant in that it indicates communication from the Creator to a human. And I would like to add that this is not the first time that we have a record in the Torah of God communicating to Avram. In fact, if you will recall, in Genesis chapter 12, and I will just use my standard, New Revised Standard Version, just for the flow of the class. In Genesis chapter 12, you'll recall that Jehovah said to Avram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to a land that I'll show you, and I will make of you a great nation. I'll bless you and make your name great so that you'll be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. So this particular communication is between God and to Avram, but it's announced in a different way. It just begins, Jehovah said, Vayomer Adonai. In chapter 12, verse 7, we have another occurrence of a communication between Jehovah and Avram. It says, Jehovah appeared to Avram, and he said, to your seed I'll give this land. And then in chapter 13, in verse 14, the third communication between Jehovah and Avram occurs, and it says in chapter 13, verse 14, Jehovah said to Avram, after Lot had separated from him, raise your eyes now and look from the place where you are, north and south and east and west. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. And I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. Rise up, walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. These three accounts of conversation between God and between Avram are interesting, and they're much related in that they generally provide the groundwork, the foundation for the promises to the fathers. These particular phrases are consistent in that they always talk of land and or progeny. Recall that Avram has no children. In fact, that comes out even more clearly in today's teaching. And yet his descendants, we are told, will number vast multitudes. Each of these conversations relate the promises to Avram, but it's the delivery of this particular message that's different, and for that reason, I think it's quite significant. because we learn that this time, that this continuous flowing narrative comes through the agency, if you will, of Devar Yehovah, a spoken thing of Yehovah, but it's how that spoken thing is delivered. It comes in the form of a vision. I want to read a couple of passages to you, but I want you to please note that this continuous narrative is a vision. Now, if you'll go with me to the book of Job, chapter 4, Job 4, and verse 12 is where I'd like to begin. Job 4, verse 12. And now a thing was secretly brought to me, and mine ear received a whisper thereof. In thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falls upon men, fear came upon me in trembling, which made all my bones to shake. Then a spirit passed before my face, the hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the appearance thereof. A form was before my eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice. Now, this particular account in the book of Job seems to go along with what we're talking. The word we're going to explore, the word for vision, is used here in Job chapter 4. One other passage from Job, incidentally. If you'll go with me to Job chapter 33, beginning in verse 14, it says, "For God speaks once, yea, twice, though man regards it not, in a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls upon men, in slumberings upon the bed. Then he opens the ears of men and seals their instruction." This needs to be emphasized from the outset for what follows, while real. Don't think that I'm not saying it's real, but I think that in our, for some reason, we tend to think of these things as being very literal and physical, but yet this particular text wants us to know that the encounter, the discussion, the conversation, everything that we read about taking place is taking place in a vision. What follows in Hebrew is expressed in this particular chapter, b'machazeh. Literally, it's in what is a vision. The spoken word of Yehovah comes to Avram, b'machazeh, in what is a vision. The root word chazah means literally to envision, to see. Yes, it means to see, but often in a prophetic sense, not always seeing future, you know, like we tend to think of, but seeing what others can't see. It is an opening of the eyes. I'll give you an example. Let's go through a few texts that talk about, that use this particular word. If you'll go with me to the book of Exodus, to Shemot, Exodus chapter 24, beginning in verse 9. Listen closely. "Then went up Moses and Aharon and Nadav and Abihu and the 70 elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and as it were, the very heavens for clearness. And upon the nobles of the children of Israel, he laid not his hand. And they beheld God and did eat and drink." But we also have passages that say that no one can see God. So when we read passages like this, we're forced to make a call. We're forced to think about, what does it mean? What we have here is an encounter where the people see the God of Israel, and the word there is chazah, the root word. It means to envision. It's a vision that's granted. This particular word is also used in the book of Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers. If you'll go with me to Numbers chapter 24, You will recognize, those of you who know your Bible, that these are the words of Bilam. Bilam, in verse 4, 24 of Numbers, says, "He saith, who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down and having his eyes open." And scroll down to verse 11. Chapter 16, verse 16. This again is Bilam. "He saith, who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down and having his eyes open." Now, interestingly enough, you might recognize the phrase "eyes open" in Psalm 119, verse 18. The Hebrew says, "Gal einai v'avita nifla ot mitorateka." Open my eyes, literally, to peel back my eyes, and I will look for wonderful things in your Torah. And this is that particular idea that he says he falls down, but his eyes are literally opened up as though by someone else. In Isaiah, if you'll go with me there, just to catch a couple of these phrases, just so that you get a feel for the use of this particular word, chazah. In Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "The vision of Isaiah, son of Amos, which he saw, asher chazah." Now, this particular phrase, in this particular verse, it begins chazon, the chazon of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he chazah, which he saw. These are related terms. They both have to do with envisioning, if you will. But this occurs variously throughout the prophets. If you went to Isaiah chapter 2, verse 1, you would see the word used there. If you went to chapter 3, verse 1, you will see the word used there. In Amos chapter 1, same exact Hebrew word. Micah 1:1, Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1. All of these talk about this chazah, these seeing ones. What they are allowed to see is a chazah, a chazon, a vision. It doesn't mean it's not real. They are permitted to see what others don't see and can't see. They have insight, if you will. Now, the book of Daniel uses over and over and over this particular word. I started to count them, but you can just simply do a search in any good Bible software or in a concordance, and you will see the repetition of this word in the Hebrew and or the Aramaic in its related forms. Here's the idea. This particular idea of seeing what others don't see, quite often we, looking upon a text which describe these things, interpret things based upon what we read. But as you know, when you read in the book of Daniel, for instance, when you read in the book of Ezekiel, you are being shown a vision where what you see is representative of something else. It is not necessarily meant to make you think about what you see as being literal in its very sense. It's very real. The example that I like to give, since we are participating offline in a study of the book of Daniel, is that you have in Daniel chapter 7, "Behold, and I saw in the night visions, and one like the Son of Man is presented to the Ancient of Days," and so forth. And we know how that's been interpreted. The interpretation, however, is given in the text when Daniel is confused and troubled and asks for explanation. He's told the meaning that this one like the Son of Man represents the kingdom of the saints of the Most High. In other words, a chazah, a chazon, gives one these images. Oftentimes they're images of beast, They're images of animals. They're images of all these things. But it's what they represent that we have to seek to understand. Now, one who has insight, this type of insight or ability to see in Hebrew is called a Jose, not the Spanish Jose, the Hebrew Jose. Jose is one who can look into and see things very much, very vividly that others can't see. Scripture records several of these Hozim, these visionaries. So I would translate a Jose as a visionary. It's a different word than what you might think when you think of prophet and seer. I'm going to cover that today. And the reason I have to go into this at the level I'm going into it is because you need to understand going into this continuous flowing narrative of Genesis 15 that what we are seeing is a printed description of something that Avram saw in a chazeh, a vision. And David, King David, had a Jose by the name of Gad. And Gad is mentioned in four particular texts where he's called the Jose, which is to David. And those texts, I have all the references. We're not going to read through all of them. But just as an example, if you will go with me to 2 Samuel chapter 24, verse 11. 2 Samuel 24, verse 11. It says, "And when David rose up in the morning, the word of Jehovah came unto," now notice, it says, "the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying." So he is a prophet, right? If you look at the Hebrew, it says, and there's our word of Jehovah, our Devar Jehovah, Haya El Gad Hanavi. It says, and the word of Jehovah was to Gad, G-A-D, the Navi, the prophet. And then it goes on to qualify that by saying, Jose David Lemor, the visionary of David. Yes, he is a prophet. He's a Navi. But if you're a prophet and you don't have the ability to chazah, you see, they're related terms. They're connected in many, many texts. But you must understand that we are talking very specifically about the ability to see. There are various understandings of the word Navi. Navi is a word generally translated as prophet, though translations sometimes confuse this. But Navi, some scholars have proposed that its root meaning is associated with the idea of bringing, from the root word bo, which means to come or to go, to bring a message, if you will. Perhaps a message of something that has been shown to them. Here are some other chazim, some other visionaries that are described in the Bible. Perhaps you've heard of Edo. How about Yehu? How about Asaph? How about Haman? Another Jose. How about Yudatan? There's an unnamed visionary who spoke to Menasheh in 2 Chronicles 33, verse 18. The prophet Amos is called a Jose in chapter 7 and verse 12. And generally, the occurrences of Jose is generally translated as a seer. So like when you read in your English Bible, if I were to give you these references, almost without exception, people will look in their English Bible and they'll find, for instance, it says of Gad that he is David's seer. Right? That's the word they choose to translate. But if chazah means a vision, then a chose is one who visions, or a visionary is the word that I would choose. But that was not chosen by most translators. So generally, like I said, they will use the word seer. But here's what problem that causes. How many of you remember the verse from 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 9? Let's look at that. I want to read that in English. In 1 Samuel, this is why it's important to look words up in the original. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 9, it says, "Before time in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, thus he said, 'Come, let us go to the seer.' For he that is now called a prophet was before time called a seer." Now, if you don't know, if you can't see what the Hebrew says there, you might assume that the seer of 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 9, is the same Hebrew word that's translated as seer when we're talking about Gad. You go, well, what difference does it make? I think it makes a big difference. I think we ought to call things by the way they should be called. So you have a visionary, which is a chose. You have a seer, which is a roe. And you have a prophet, which is a navi. Now, let me show them to you all in one verse. Go with me to 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles, chapter 29, verse 29. Now, I'm going to read the English. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 29. It says, "And he died in a good old age, full of days, riches, and honor. And Solomon his son reigned in his stead. Now the acts of David the king, first and last, behold, they are written in the history of Samuel the seer, and in the history of Nathan the prophet, and in the history of Gad the seer." So you would assume, reading, that Samuel is a seer, Nathan is a prophet, and Gad is a seer like the first. Like Samuel. But in Hebrew, Samuel is called a roe, one who sees. The root word there is ra'ah, to see. You have Nathan is called the Navi, the one who brings the message. And think about it. We know that Nathan brought some of these messages, such as, "Thou art the man," remember? And then we get to this idea of Gad, who is the Hose. Here's the idea. The main point, the main idea, is that special seeing capabilities were given to select individuals throughout the biblical narrative. They were sometimes called by various names, but they have insight. They can see things, they can hear things that others can't see, can't hear. For those who have eyes to see, in this sense, to envision. In other words, it's calling on the seeing ones to see. Indeed, the prophet Amos says in chapter 3, verse 7, that God does nothing unless he reveals his secrets unto his servants, the prophets. In which case, that word prophet is tied to the root Navi. Now, we're not there yet in the Hebrew Bible. We're only in Genesis chapter 15, the vision of Avram. But when we get to chapter 20 of Genesis, in verse 7, we will learn that Avram is called a Navi. Now, go look at that verse with me. Let's just look at Genesis chapter 20, verse 7. Genesis chapter 20, verse 7 says the following. "Now therefore, restore the man's wife," talking about Avram's wife, "for he is a prophet, and he shall pray for you, and you shall live. And if you do not restore, know thou that you shall surely die, you and all that are yours. Right? Think about this. This is the first occurrence in the Hebrew Bible of the word Navi. And what we learn about a Navi here is that he has some special connection with the Creator. He can pray for you and things will be okay, but you work against him and you will die. We know in Deuteronomy chapter 18 when it gives us this idea of what it is that a prophet will be. We're told very clearly that the people of Israel are going to have communication with the divine realm, but it won't be according to the manner in which other nations do. Now, Israel loves to do it like the nations. We're going to learn that as we work through it. But the bottom line is, God says, it's not going to be this. He doesn't say it doesn't work. He doesn't say that you can't hear from these various occultic practices like necromancy or spiritism. He simply says it's forbidden and it's unnecessary, because the way he's going to communicate to his people is through the agency of the prophet, through the agency of these who can see what others can't see, not necessarily future events, though sometimes that's the case. You can see in the contemporaneous events of the day, and they are able then to bring that message forward. Amos says, remember, chapter 3, verse 7, he does nothing unless he reveals his secret unto his servants, the prophets. Go with me to Numbers chapter 12, verse 6. I have quite a bit to cover today. Numbers chapter 12, verse 6 says the following. And he said, this is Jehovah speaking, and I'm reading a translation, so stick with me. If there be a prophet, a Navi among you, I, Jehovah, will make myself known unto him in a vision. Now, this particular passage, it concludes with, I will speak with him in a dream. I will make myself known, is what it says, by what is shown to him. In other words, Jehovah is going to show this Navi something that will make the Navi know him. The Hebrew, by the way, is very intriguing at this point, and I'm not going to go into exactly how strange the Hebrew reading is there, but it is very bizarre. But it does say further, I'll continue, when it says, in the dream I speak, it says, in the dream I speak in him. In him. Could be with him, but the idea is that within this person, in the dream, he is spoken in. Very interesting idea. We are in the 15th chapter of the book of Genesis, and for some reason, people imagine that it went down like this. That Jehovah walked up, looked in the tent, called Avram outside and put his arm around Avram and walked him out under the stars. We want to read this as it is an event that took place in the physical, in the literal, ignoring, if you will, the fact that it says that the spoken thing came towards Avram b'machazeh, in the vision. It's a vision. It's a vision, people. In fact, the Bible, as I will show and as we continuously work through these narratives, story after story, you will see over and again stories with which you are familiar that you have missed this point altogether. I'll give you an example. Do you remember the story where King Solomon, after he assumes the throne, says that he goes and offers many sacrifices at Gibeon, and he hears the Lord's voice? Jehovah says to him, Solomon, what would I give you? This is 1 Kings 3, and I'm paraphrasing. You know, what do you want? And Solomon responds to Jehovah. He speaks back to him. You would think of this as it's a meeting between Jehovah and Solomon. And many times people say, I wish God would speak to us like that because I would believe that, you know, I've heard this before. So notice, and he says, well, all I want is to be wise to be able to lead your great people. Jehovah answers him. It's a dialogue. Solomon says this, then Jehovah says this. Jehovah says, well, because you've only asked for this, I'm going to give you riches and honor and wisdom. And this story goes back and forth and back and forth. But before the story and at the close of the story, one thing is told to us. It was a dream. It was a dream. I'm not saying it wasn't real. I'm saying that the communication is on a different plane, in a different manner, in a different form than what you have imagined. I often use this illustration. The first time I saw The Wizard of Oz, and I so loved the movie as a child, I remember that I was very disappointed at the end when they found themselves back in the home and Dorothy is in bed and all of her loved ones are standing around, and I kept thinking that I wanted the flying monkeys back. I wanted the story to be in that world. What I think people have done in many ways, in many particular texts and passages, is they have ignored the plain reading of the text. And when it says that it's a vision, we have to understand that, because it puts us, I don't know how to put this other than to say, it puts the possibility, the realm of possibility, that this can happen in our day in a much more believable fashion. These communications, the vision begins, fear not. There's a conversation. Just as Jehovah spoke to Solomon in a dream, the vision begins to Avram, fear not. 74 times in Scripture, you'll read this particular phrase, fear not. But many of the patriarchal stories are communicated in the form of visions and dreams. I want you to look at a couple of them with me, just to make sure that we make this point. Genesis chapter 26 and verse 24. Jehovah appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham, your father. Fear not, here's our phrase, for I am with you, and I will bless you and multiply your seed for my servant Abraham's sake. And when you read that, you might say, well, that doesn't say it's a vision. But I want you to understand the way that this language is communicated. Look with me to Genesis chapter 46, Genesis 46. In verse 2, we're going to read verses 2 through 4. And Elohim, Vayomer Elohim l'Israel, and God spoke into Israel, unto Israel, in the visions of the night, and said, Yaakov, Yaakov. And he said, Hineni, here am I. I want you to notice, the God of all creation is speaking to Israel, to Jacob, in visions. And in this vision, Jacob is able to answer him. You see, there's a dialogue there, but it's in a vision. Here am I. And he said, I am the God of your father. Fear not, there it is again, to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of you a great nation. I will go down with you into Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph shall put his hands upon your eyes. One of the most incredible passages in Scripture to me. God tells him in this dream, you're going to Egypt, and I'm going with you. And it will be me who will bring you back. A lot of people don't think about God being in Egypt. that he goes with Israel and says he'll bring him back. You'll recall that in Genesis chapter 28, in Genesis chapter 28, there is a vision, a dream, when Jacob is fleeing from Esau and he's going and he comes upon a certain place and he takes a stone and he sets it up and he puts his head there and he goes to sleep. And in that particular dream, he's told, look at this, let's just go there. Genesis chapter 28. Genesis 28. I'm not going to read the entire episode, but it begins, or the story begins in verse 10. Verse 12 says, "And he dreamed, behold, a ladder set up on the earth." Now, was there really a ladder set up on the earth? He's a dreamer. He's dreaming of this ladder. And it says, "Behold, the top of it reached to the heaven, and the angels, the messengers of God, were ascending and descending. And Jehovah stood over above it and said, I am Jehovah, the God of your father, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob," and so forth. And he tells him, verse 15, "And behold, I am with you. I will keep you whithersoever you go and will bring you again to this land, for I will not leave you until I've done that which I've spoken." And then Jacob, verse 16, awaked out of his sleep and said, "Surely Jehovah is in this place." When you understand that God is communicating to his people in the form of a dream, just like it says in Numbers chapter 12, verse 6, that's how it's going to happen. We tend to think of these things in a very literal sense, and we thereby cause ourselves to think that things are so different now than they were then. He tells him, "Fear not." He tells him, "I am a shield to you." Many, many passages in the Hebrew Bible that refer to Jehovah as a shield. I should remind you that Avram has just returned from battling the other kings. So a shield is something that he fully understands. A shield, a magin, a shield is what Jehovah says. I am your protector, basically. The one who protects you from attacks from without. Over and over in Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 29, it talks about a shield. I'd call your attention to Psalm 3, verse 3, just to give you a couple of passages. Psalm 3, verse 3. David understood a shield. "But you, O Jehovah, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter up of my head." The idea that David understood is that when he went to battle, that it was Jehovah who would be his shield. You'll recall in Psalm 18, in three places, he refers to his God as the shield of him. The same particular psalm is quoted in 2 Samuel chapter 22. Many, many of the Psalms talk about how God is a shield to his people. He tells him, "Your reward is great." Jehovah, in this vision, we're in a vision. He tells Avram, "Your reward is great." Now look, Avram has a question. "My reward is great." You know, he asked a question. This is informative for us. It's not against the rules to question God. He actually asked God, "What will you give to me?" Right? You say my reward is great. What will you give to me? He goes, "I'm walking stripped." He says, He says, "I have nothing. My heir is Damasek Eliezer," Eliezer of Damascus. In other words, someone born in my household that's not even my heir is my heir. and my reward is great, what will you give to me? Avram is assured in this dialogue, in a vision, right? He's assured that this son of his house isn't the one. In other words, Eliezer of Damascus, Damasek Eliezer, will not be your heir, but one that comes from your insides. Your literal descendant will be your heir. Remember, this is a vision. He takes him outside, and he shows him the stars in the heavens. Now, if your mind has previously thought that Jehovah and Avram are walking together in the physical realm and they go out under the stars, you're doing what I've done for many, many years. But I want to think about this as the text says. It's a vision. And he shows him the many, many stars in the heavens. And the one who, as Psalm 147:4 says, created the stars and named them all. The one who did that tells Avram, if you can count the stars, then so will your seed be. Imagine the desert sky when there are no street lights or anything on a clear night. And he beholds this and he tells him, so shall your seed be. And this particular phrase in Hebrew is used four times, and all of which are instructive when we talk about the descendants of the patriarchs. We have two of the occurrences here in Genesis 15. In Genesis 28, verse 14, which I read, the vision that Jacob has, he tells him that your descendants will be like the dust of the earth. Your seed will be. Psalm 112:2, it says, your seed will be mighty in the land. Our vision continues. And the vision, after receiving this view of the sky at night, right? It has to be at night in order to see the skies. I'm going to make a point in a minute and you'll say, oh, maybe he's right. Avram, it says, trusted. He put his trust in what Jehovah had just told him. And because of that, it says he thought it to him justness, tzedakah, righteousness. You see, he put his confidence in that word, that promise. He just had told Jehovah, I walk stripped. I don't even have a child. And you're talking about all this? See, but it's a vision of what's to be. The children of Israel aren't literally stars in the heavens. He's showing him an image so that he will grasp what it is that he needs him to understand. He's saying things that don't yet exist. This is the God who told Avram, go from the everything that's familiar to you to a place that I'll show you. Unseen. Trusted. Vehe'emin. The root word there is aman. You know the word amen. People can look this up on your own, but the basic level of this word, at its basic level, it means firmness, something that's solid. In fact, I like the word firm whenever I see a root that's tied to this word that's tied to the root idea of aman. Firm. To affirm means to assert as valid. To confirm. Notice how I've retained the word firm in both of these. To confirm means to give assurance of the validity of. It has to do with, you can rest assured on this. In other words, it's solid. Stand firm. Look, if you will, to the book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk chapter 2. Habakkuk chapter 2. And verse 4. I just want to look at the second half of this verse. It says, the righteous shall live by his faith. Now, the reason I went to this verse is because chapter 15, verse 6 of Genesis uses the same two Hebrew verbs that this verse uses. So the idea is that Habakkuk chapter 2 is telling us that the one who is tzaddik, the righteous, in his, and then the word is emunah, in his faithfulness, in his firmness, in his, you know, this idea that we just talked about for Avram, in that he will live. So what we find is that according to this text in Genesis, because he trusted, he put his faith in, if you will, it was counted to him for righteousness. The vision continues. I am Jehovah who made you go out. This is the same redemptive language, the description used for Jehovah when speaking of the Exodus from Egypt. Exodus chapter 20, verse 2. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 6. He says, I am Jehovah who brought you forth from the land of Egypt. So this God is a God who brings you out of bondage, if you will. The God who brought his people out of slavery to give this land. Avram, still in the vision, has a question. He's got another question. With what will I know that I will possess it? So he sees, he's told the promise and he said, look, I don't have any kids. You told me I'm going to have all these kids. I'm walking stripped. How will I know I get that? And he says, okay, well, look at the stars. And then he says, I'm going to bring you out. I'm the God who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldees. And he goes, okay, with what shall I know that I'm going to possess this land? And then the most bizarre thing. Remember the question. You have to ask yourself in this vision, how does the thing that's fixing to be described answer the question of how am I going to know that I'm going to get into the land? When he asks, how do I know I'm going to have kids? He shows him stars. Well, that's not really the kids. I mean, he could have just showed him people as far as you could see. But he wanted to illustrate something. So he used something and he go, look at the star. They're going to be like this. Oh, okay. Wouldn't it have been easier just to show him millions and millions and millions and millions of people? It's a vision. It's a vision. So he asked him, how do I know I'm going to get this land? Now, the vision gets dark here. This morning, I was thinking of the late Leonard Cohen's final song, You Want It Darker? The vision grows dark. I wish that I was a talented movie maker for this part of the class, that I could show you on film the vision as a vision and let you see as Avram sees what's coming next. We tend to separate this part. This part we think, well, that's not a vision anymore. This is like literally happening. But it's a vision. Now, there is a story, the vision. Avram is told to bring in this vision a heifer and a goat and a ram and a turtle dove and a nestling, and divide them in the middle. Now, in our mind, we think of this as a literal act, and I know some people are thinking that it is. In fact, we have passages, what is called a covenant of the grant, in Jeremiah chapter 34, verse 18 and 22, where it talks about, and all covenant teachers begin to look on this as a very literal act because they know that in antiquity, there was this rite of passage where the parties of a covenant would walk between the halves. But this is talking about, in this vision, divide these in half. Now stay with me, you'll see this. So I want you to imagine that these animals are right down the middle through the skull. All halves are placed on either side. And what, by the way, does this have to do with the question, how will I know that I'm going to inherit the land? You could say, well, he's establishing, Ross, keep reading, you'll see it's a covenant. But wait, the question is, how do I know I'm going to get the land? We'll go chop up a goat. And you see the idea of the question? So then in the vision, Avram sees birds of prey come down, and it says, now imagine me the movie maker. So we're watching these perfectly divided halves. The birds of prey come down, and it says literally that Avram blows them away in the vision. We want to imagine that he runs out chasing these birds off the carcasses with a stick. The birds of prey come in, and it says Avram blew the birds of prey go away. At this point, you might think I'm forcing things on the text, that it's not a vision. Look at Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15. And I want to go, excuse me while I open my translation here. I want to go to verse 12. And it was the sun to come in, and a deep sleep fell upon Avram and said, and look, a terror, a dark, large darkness was falling upon him. Now, if you notice, your translation is probably going to say sunset, when the sun comes in. Have you been following what I've been saying? Because I want you to ask yourself, it's now sunset, but didn't he just take him out and show him the stars? Was it not night a few verses earlier? Yes, it was. It's a vision. In the vision, imagine the clouds moving quickly, the darkness and viewing the sky and being told your descendants will be like this. The sun beginning to set and it grows darker. And it grows darker. And it says that a tardema comes upon Avram. He now goes into the deepest part of sleep. This word tardema is like a trance-like state. It's further in. He's growing darker. And it says that this deep darkness comes upon him. By the way, this particular word, tardema, is used in Genesis chapter 2, verse 21. When Adam, it says a tardema comes upon him. This is from Jehovah. And a rib is pulled and a woman is fashioned. And you'll recall that in 1 Samuel chapter 26, verse 12, when David is in hiding and Saul's troops are chasing him, and you'll recall that that Saul is asleep and his great generals are supposed to be protecting him, but Jehovah sends a tardema on the group, and David's able to walk in and just get his spear. In Isaiah chapter 29, verse 10, if you'll look at that with me, I just want to pick this verse up. Isaiah chapter 29, verse 10, it says the following. For Jehovah has poured out upon you the spirit of tardema, like a spiritual trance, if you will, and has closed your eyes, the prophets. By the way, the word there is Nevi'im, the prophets. And your heads, the seers, he has covered. That word is chozim. So the idea in Isaiah 29 is that those who are supposed to possess this insight don't possess the insight. The prophets, their eyes are closed. The seers, their heads are covered. It's like you can't see, even the ones who are supposed to. But back to our vision, a terror, a large darkness was falling upon them. So now it's dark. Although earlier, just a few verses earlier, in a continuous narrative, he's seen, he's shown the stars. You'll recall also that the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3, do you remember what that was about? Moses in chapter 3 of Exodus says, I will turn and see what this great sight is, that the bush burns, but it's not consumed. And he's told that that would be a sign. He sees it. That would be a sign for later when the children of Israel are brought out of Egypt. Now, what's on fire in the Exodus? The mountain. Now, the bush is not the mountain, but it's a picture of what's coming. He's envisioning these things. This is the stuff of dreams and visions. Something is shown, it's meant to point to something else. As the sun goes down, when it was already described as being a star-filled night, things get even darker still. Tardama comes upon Avram, taking him deeper in the darkness. And he learns about a very dark time for his descendants, who, by the way, are not yet. He doesn't have any kids yet. He's told, you'll be sojourners in a land not theirs. The servants, they will be servants of those who bring them low for 400 years, followed by judgment on the oppressing ones. And they're going to come out with great possessions. Avram is told that he'll die old, but he's assured that his seed will return when the crookedness of the Amorites is complete. And then in the darkness, in the vision, he beholds a fire pot of smoke passing between the halves. What could this mean? It's a vision given to the Navi, to the prophet, to Avram. But what does it mean? So these are my ideas when I read through this text. I just want to cover a couple of high points. What do they represent? If you go to Jeremiah chapter 12, Jeremiah 12, beginning in verse 7, it says, I have forsaken my house. I've cast off my heritage. I've given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. My heritage has become unto me as a lion in the forest. She's uttered her voice against me. Therefore, I've hated her. Is my heritage unto me as a speckled bird of prey? Are the birds of prey against her round about? Go ye, assemble all the beasts of the field, bring them to devour. Many shepherds have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They've made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. They've made it a desolation. It mourns unto me, being desolate. The whole land is made desolate, because no man lays it to heart. Destroyers are come upon all the bare heights of the wilderness, for the sword of Jehovah devours from one end of the land even to the other. This idea, this vision is talking about God's heritage, His place, and who is it that's described as the birds of prey who are coming down? I'm reminded of a phrase, where the carcasses are, there will be birds of prey gathered. In Isaiah 18:6, Ezekiel chapter 39, verse 4, we learn about this final great battle, and the birds of prey are there. Some ideas to consider. We talk about this flaming torch and so forth. I'm just going to roll through a couple of these, if you'll bear with me. In Isaiah 62, verse 1, "For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest, until her righteousness go forth as brightness, and her salvation as a torch that burns." In Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 13, in this vision that Ezekiel is given of wheels within wheels, and wherever the beast went, you'll recall this vision that he's shown. Talks about torches going back and forth. If you go with me to Zechariah, Zechariah chapter 12, verse 6, Zechariah 12, verse 6. "In that day will I make the chieftains of Judah like a pan of fire among wood, and like a flaming torch among sheaves, and they shall devour all the people round about, on the right and on the left, and they of Jerusalem shall yet again dwell in their own place, even in Jerusalem." In Daniel chapter 10, verse 6, "The eyes of Jehovah are compared to a flaming torch." These are images that are associated with redemption. One more. Look at Isaiah chapter 31. Isaiah chapter 31, verse 9. "And his rock shall pass away by reason of terror, and his princes shall be dismayed at the ensign, says Jehovah, whose fire is in Zion, whose furnace is in Jerusalem." You may remember in Malachi 4:1, in chapter 3, verse 19, there's this idea of a burning, a purging. What we get is that over and over and over, we see redemption associating with this flaming torch, with this fire. Look with me to Psalm 136, Psalm 136. Verse 13. It says, "To him that divided the Red Sea in sunder," and then as all verses in this psalm conclude, "for his loving kindness endures forever." This idea of two pieces, there's a separation in between the two pieces in the vision representing something. The torch and the flame passes. In Psalm 136, verse 13, it's the same Hebrew word for the division of the pieces. Gezer, it's this idea that two would be separated. The vision of Avram goes like this. Avram's descendants were to become numerous as the stars of heaven, to sojourn in a land not theirs. They were to be oppressed. This is a dark vision. But at the specified time, judgment would come upon the oppressing ones. And the one who is described in terms of fire would lead them out, passing between the two pieces, the congealed walls of the sea on either side. Indeed, the birds of prey have assembled against the heritage of Jehovah, as Jeremiah chapter 12 makes plain. But Avram's seed, at the right time, will blow away the birds of prey. And if we read the closing of the vision as I close today, it says the following. "And on that day, Jehovah cut with Avram a pact, saying, 'To your seed I give this land, from the river of Egypt unto the large river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Rephaim, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Girgashite, and the Jebusite.'" Thus concludes the vision of Avram. Shabbat Shalom.